Sneed. Because Hark found the bank that'll loan the money to buy Sneed. Because Hark is willing to sign the papers and your boys are too ethical. This is a nasty business, TJ. Hark understands it.
He strikes me as being a crooked bastard.
Yes, and he's our crook. If we join forces, his take goes from 25 to 20. If we can bring in Mary Ross, then he'll cut it to 17.5. Libigail down to 15.
We'll never get Libigail.
There's always a chance. If the three of us are on board, she might listen.
What about that thug she's married to?
Troy Jr. actually asked the question with complete sincerity. He was talking to his brother, who was married to a stripper.
We'll take him one at a time. Let's cut our deal, then we go see Mary Ross. Her lawyer is that grit guy, and he doesn't strike me as being too sharp.
There's no sense fighting, Troy Jr. said sadly.
It'll cost us a bloody fortune. It's time for a truce.
Mom will be proud.
The high ground on the Shekko had been used by the Indians for decades. It was a camp for fishermen who sometimes stayed the night, and it was a stopping place for river traffic. Rachel and Laco, and another tribesman named Ten, huddled under a lean-to with a straw roof and waited for the storm to pass. The roof leaked, and the wind blew the rain sideways at their faces. The canoe was at their feet, dragged from the Shekko after battling the storm for a horrifying hour. Rachel's clothing was soaked, but at least the rainwater was warm. The Indians wore no clothing except for a string around their waists and a leather covering over their privates. She once had a wooden boat with an old motor. It had belonged to the Coopers, her predecessors. When there was gasoline, she used it on the rivers between the four Ipica settlements. And it would take her to Corumbá in 2 very long days, 4 on the return. The motor had finally quit, and there was no money for a new one. Each year, when she submitted her modest budget to World Tribes, she prayerfully requested a new outboard, or at least a good used one. She had found one in Corumbá for $300, but budgets were tight around the world. Her allotments went for medical supplies and Bible literature. "Keep praying," she was told, "maybe next year." She accepted this without question. If the Lord meant for her to have a new outboard, then she would have one. The questions of if and when were left for him. They were not for her to worry about. Without a boat, she traveled between the villages on foot, almost always with Laco limping at her side. And once each August she convinced the chief to loan her a canoe and a guide for the journey to the Paraguay. There she would wait for a cattle boat or a chawana headed south. 2 years before, she had waited for 3 days, sleeping in the stable of a small fazenda on the river. In 3 days she went from a stranger to a friend to a missionary, as the farmer and his wife became Christians under her teachings and prayer. She would stay with them tomorrow and wait for a boat to Corumbá. The wind howled through the lean-to. She held Laco's hand and they prayed, not for their safety, but for the health of their friend, Nate. Breakfast was served to Mr. Stafford at his desk, cereal and fruit. He refused to leave the office, and when he declared that he would in fact hole up there all day, both of his secretaries scurried to rearrange no less than 6 meetings. A bagel at 10 at the desk. He called Valdir and was told that he was out of the office, in a meeting somewhere across town. Valdir had a cell phone. Why hadn't he called? An associate delivered a 2-page summary of dengue taken from the Internet. The associate said he was needed in court and asked if Mr. Stafford had any more medical work for him. Mr. Stafford did not see the humor. Josh read the summary with his bagel. It was in all caps, double-spaced with 1-inch margins, about 1.5 pages long. A Stafford memo. Dengue fever is a viral infection common throughout the tropical regions of the world. It is spread by a mosquito known as the Aedes, which prefers to bite during the day. The first sign is tiredness, followed quickly by a severe headache behind the eyes, then a mild fever that soon turns into an intense one, with sweating and nausea and vomiting. As the fever rises, the muscles in the calves and back begin to ache. The fever is also known as breakbone fever because of the brutal muscle and joint pains. A rash appears after all other symptoms are present. The fever may break for a day or so, but it usually returns with increased intensity. After about a week, the infection wanes and the danger is gone. There is no cure and no vaccine. It takes a month of rest and liquids to return to normal. And that's a mild case. Dengue can progress into dengue hemorrhagic fever or dengue shock syndrome, both of which are sometimes fatal, especially in children. Josh was prepared to send Mr. Phelan's jet to Corumbá to collect Nate. On board would be a doctor and a nurse and anything else that might be needed.
"It's Mr. Valdir," a secretary said through the intercom. No other calls were being taken.
He was at the hospital.
"I've just checked on Mr. O'Reilly," he said slowly, precisely. "He is okay, but he is not very conscious."
"Can he talk?" Josh asked.
"No, not now. They're giving him drugs for his pain."
"Does he have a good doctor?"
"The best, a friend of mine. The doctor's with him now."
"Ask him when Mr. O'Reilly will be able to fly home. I will send a private jet and a doctor to Corumbá."
There was a conversation in the background.
"Not soon," Valdir reported. "He will need rest when he leaves the hospital."
"When will he leave the hospital?"
Another conversation.
"He can't say right now."
Josh shook his head and flung the remnants of his bagel into the wastebasket.
"Did you say anything to Mr. O'Reilly?" he growled at Valdir.
"No, I think he's asleep."
"Listen, Mr. Valdir, it is very important that I talk to him as soon as possible, okay?"
"I understand this, but you must be patient."
"I'm not a patient man."
"I understand this, but you must try."
"Call me this afternoon."
Josh slammed the phone down and began pacing. It had been an unwise decision to send Nate, fragile and unstable as he was, into the dangers of the tropics. Convenience had been the reason. Send him away for a couple of weeks more, keep him busy elsewhere while the firm sorts out his mess. There were four lesser partners in his firm besides Nate, four Josh had handpicked and hired and mentored and listened to on some matters of management. Tip was one, and he was the sole voice of support for Nate. The other three wanted him gone. Nate's secretary had been reassigned. A rising associate had been borrowing his office lately and was said to have found a home. If dengue fever didn't get poor Nate, the IRS was waiting. The IV bag emptied silently around the middle of the day, though no one bothered to check it. Several hours later, Nate woke up. His head was light and at peace, with no fever. He was stiff, but not sweating. He felt the heavy gauze over his eyes, felt the tape holding it there, and after some thought decided to have a look. His left arm held the IV, so he began picking at the tape with the fingers of his right hand. He was aware of voices in another room and steps on a hard floor. People were busy down the hall. Closer, someone was moaning in a low, steady, painful voice. He slowly worked the tape from his skin and hair and cursed the person who'd stuck it there. He laid the bandage to one side. It hung over his left ear. His first image was peeling paint, a dull shade of faded yellow on the wall just above him. The lights were off. Rays of sun drifted in from a window. The paint on the ceiling was cracked too, large black gaps shrouded with cobwebs and dust. A rickety fan dropped from the center and wobbled as it spun. 2 feet caught his attention. Two old, gnarled, scarred feet, layered with wounds and calluses from toes to soles, sticking in the air. And when he lifted his head slightly, he saw that they belonged to a shriveled little man whose bed almost touched his. He appeared dead. The moaning came from the wall near the window. This poor guy was just as small and just as shriveled. He sat in the middle of his bed, arms and legs folded and tucked into a ball, and suffered his affliction in a trance. The smell was of old urine, human waste, and heavy antiseptic all mixed into one thick odor. Nurses laughed down the hall. The paint was peeling on every wall. There were 5 beds besides Nate's, all of the rollaway variety, parked here and there with little effort at order. His 3rd roommate was by the door. He was naked, except for a wet diaper, and his body was covered with open red sores. He too appeared dead, and Nate certainly hoped he was, for his own good. There were no buttons to push, no emergency cord or intercom, no way to summon help except for yelling. And this might wake the dead. These creatures might arise and want to visit with him. He wanted to run, to swing his feet off the bed, onto the floor, rip the IV from his arm, and sprint for freedom. He would take his chances on the street. Surely there couldn't be as much disease out there. Any place was better than this leper's ward. But his feet were like bricks. Nate tried mightily to lift them, one at a time, but they barely moved. Nate sunk his head to his pillow, closed his eyes, and thought about crying. "I am in a hospital in a third world country," he said over and over. "I left Walnut Hill, $1,000 a day, push-button everything, carpet, showers, therapists at my beck and call." The man with the sores grunted, and Nate sank even lower. Then he carefully took the gauze and placed it over his eyes, and he taped it, just like before, only tighter this time. Chapter 35. Sneed arrived for the meeting with a contract of his own, one he had prepared without the aid of a lawyer. Hark read it, and had to admit that it was not a bad job of drafting. It was titled Contract for Expert Witness Services. Experts give opinions. Sneed would deal primarily with the facts, but Hark didn't care what the contract said. He signed it and handed over a certified check for $500,000. Sneed took it delicately, examined every word, then folded it and tucked it away in his coat pocket. "Now where do we start?" he said with a smile. There was so much to cover. The other Phelan lawyers wanted to be present. Hark had time only for a primer. "In general terms," he said, "what was the old man's frame of mind the morning he died?" Sneed squirmed and twisted and frowned, as if in deep thought. He really wanted to say the right things. He felt as though he had $4.5 million riding on him now. "He was out of his mind," he said, the words hanging in the air while he waited for approval. Hark nodded. "So far, so good." "Was this unusual?"
"No. In his last days he was hardly rational."
"How much time did you spend with him?"
"Off and on, 24 hours a day."
"Where did you sleep?"
"My room was down the hall, but he had a buzzer for me. I was on call around the clock. He would sometimes get up in the middle of the night and want juice or a pill. He simply pushed a button, the buzzer rang me, and I fetched whatever he wanted."
"Who else lived with him?"
"No one."
"Who else did he spend time with?"
"Perhaps young Nicolette, the secretary. He fancied her."
"Did he have sex with her?"
"Would it help her case?"
"Yes."
"Then they were screwing like rabbits."
Hark couldn't help but smile. The allegation that Troy was chasing his last secretary would surprise no one. It hadn't taken long for them to find the same sheet to sing from.
Look, Mr. Sneed, this is what we want. We need the quirks, the little oddities, the glaring lapses, the strange things he said and did when taken as a whole will convince anyone that he was not of sound mind. You have time. Sit down and begin writing. Put the pieces together. Have a chat with Nicolette. Make sure they were having sex. Listen to what she says.
She'll say anything we need.
Good. Then rehearse, and make sure there are no gaps that other lawyers can find. Your stories must hold together.
There's no one to contradict them.
No one? No limo driver, or maid, or ex-lover, or maybe another secretary?
He had all those, sure. But no one lived on the 14th floor but Mr. Phelan and myself. He was a very lonely man, and quite crazy.
Then how did he perform so well for the three psychiatrists?
Sneed thought about this for a moment. Fiction failed him.
What would you guess? He asked.
I would guess that Mr. Phelan knew the examination would be difficult, because he knew he was slipping, and so he asked you to prepare lists of anticipated questions, and that you and Mr. Phelan spent that morning reviewing such simple matters as the day's date, he couldn't keep it straight, and the names of children, names he'd virtually forgotten, where they went to college, who they were married to, etc. Then you covered questions about his health. I would guess that after you had drilled him on these basics, you spent at least 2 hours prompting him on his holdings, the structure of the Phelan Group, the companies he owned, the acquisitions he'd made, the closing prices of certain stocks. He relied on you more and more for financial news, and so this came easy for you. It was tedious for the old man, but you were determined to keep him sharp just before you wheeled him in for the exam. Does this sound familiar? Sneed liked it immensely. He was awed by the lawyer's gift of creating lies on the spot.
Yes. Yes, that's it. That's how Mr. Phelan snowed the psychiatrists.
Then work on it, Mr. Sneed. The more you work on your stories, the better witness you'll be. The lawyers on the other side will come after you. They will attack your testimony and call you a liar. So you must be ready. Write everything down so you'll always have a record of your stories.
I like that idea.
Dates, times, places, incidents, oddities. Everything, Mr. Sneed. Same for Nicolette. Make her write it down.
She doesn't write well. Help her.
It's up to you, Mr. Sneed. You want the rest of the money, then earn it.
How much time do I have?
We, the other lawyers and myself, would like to video you in a few days. We'll hear your stories, pepper you with questions, then watch your performance. I'm sure we'll want to change some things. We'll coach you along, maybe do more videos. When things are perfect, then you'll be ready for your deposition.
Sneed left in a hurry. He wanted to put the money in the bank and buy a new car. Nicolette needed one, too. A night orderly on his rounds noticed the empty bag. The hand-printed instructions on the back of it said that the fluid should not be interrupted. He took it to the pharmacy, where a part-time student nurse remixed the chemicals and gave the bag back to the orderly. There were rumors around the hospital about the rich American patient. In his sleep, Nate was refortified with drugs he didn't need. When Chevy found him before breakfast, he was half awake, eyes still covered because he preferred the darkness.
"Welly's here," Chevy whispered.
The nurse on duty helped Chevy roll the bed from the room, down the hall, and into a small courtyard where there was sunshine. The nurse turned a crank, and half the bed inclined. She removed the gauze and tape, and Nate never flinched. He slowly opened his eyes and tried to focus. Chevy, just inches away, said,
"The swelling is down." "Hello, Nate," Welly said.
He was hovering on the other side. The nurse left them.
"Hello, Welly," Nate said, his words deep, slow, thick. He was groggy but happy. How well he knew the feeling of being stoned.
Chevy patted his forehead and announced, "The fever is gone, too." The Brazilians smiled at each other, relieved that they had not killed the American during their excursion into the Pantanal.
"What happened to you?"
Nate asked Welly, trying to clip his words and not sound like a drunk. Chevy passed along the question in Portuguese. Welly was instantly animated and began his long narrative about the storm and the sinking of the Santa Laura. Chevy stopped him every 30 seconds for the translation. Nate listened while trying to keep his eyes open, but he floated in and out of the scene. Valdir found them there. He greeted Nate warmly, delighted that their guest was sitting up in bed and looking better. He whipped out a cell phone, and as he punched numbers, he said, "You must talk to Mr. Stafford. He's quite anxious."
"I'm not sure I..."
Nate's words trailed off as he drifted.
"Here, sit up. He's Mr. Stafford," Valdir said, handing him the phone and puffing up his pillow.
Nate took the phone and said,
"Hello?"
"Nate," came the reply. "Is that you?"
"Josh."
"Nate, tell me you're not going to die. Please tell me."
"I'm not sure," Nate said.
Valdir gently pushed the phone closer to Nate's head and helped him hold it in place.
"Speak louder," he whispered.
Chevy and Welly stepped back.
"Nate, did you find Rachel Lane?"
Josh yelled into the phone. Nate rallied for a second. He frowned hard, trying to concentrate.
"No,"
he said.
"What?"
"Her name's not Rachel Lane."
"What the hell is it?"
Nate thought hard for a second, then fatigue hit him. He slumped a bit, still trying to remember her name. Maybe she never told him her last name.
"I don't know,"
he mumbled, his lips barely moving. Valdir pressed the phone harder.
"Nate, talk to me. Did you find the right woman?"
"Oh, yes. Everything's okay down here, Josh. Relax."
"What about the woman?"
"She's lovely."
Josh hesitated for a second, but he couldn't waste any time.
"That's nice, Nate. Did she sign the papers?"
"I can't think of her name."
"Did she sign the papers?"
There was a long pause as Nate's chin dropped to his chest and he appeared to be napping. Valdir nudged his arm and tried to move his head with the phone.
"I really liked her," Nate suddenly babbled. "A lot."
"You're stoned, aren't you, Nate? They've got you on painkillers, right?"
"Yep."
"Look, Nate, call me when your head is clear, okay?"
"I don't have a phone."
"Then use Valdir's. Please call me, Nate."
His head nodded and his eyes closed.
"I asked her to marry me," he said into the phone.
Then his chin fell for the last time. Valdir took the phone and walked to a corner. He tried to describe Nate's condition.
"Do I need to come down there?" Josh yelled for the third or fourth time.
"That is not necessary. Please be patient."
"I'm tired of you telling me to be patient."
"I understand."
"Get him well, Valdir."
"He is fine."
"No, he's not. Call me later."
Tip Durbin found Josh standing in the window of his office, staring at the cluster of buildings that composed his view. Tip closed the door, took a seat, and asked,
"What did he say?"
Josh kept staring out the window.
"He said he found her, that she's lovely, and that he asked her to marry him."
There was no trace of humor in his voice. Tip found it humorous nonetheless. When it came to women, Nate culled little, especially between divorces.
"How is he?" "Feeling no pain, pumped full of painkillers, semi-conscious. Valdir said the fever is gone and he looks much better."
"So he's not going to die?"
"It appears not."
Durbin began chuckling.
"That's our boy Nate. Never met a skirt he didn't like."
When Josh turned around, he looked quite amused.
"It's beautiful," he said. "Nate's bankrupt. She's only 42, probably hasn't seen a white man in years. Nate wouldn't care if she was ugly as sin. She happens to be the richest woman in the world."
I'm not surprised, now that I think about it. I thought I was doing him a favor, sending him off on an adventure. It never occurred to me he would try to seduce a missionary.
You think he hit on her?
Who knows what they did in the jungle?
I doubt it, Tip added on second thought.
We know Nate, but we don't know her. It takes two.
Josh sat on the edge of his desk, still amused, grinning at the floor.
You're right. I'm not sure she would go for Nate. There's a lot of baggage.
Did she sign the papers?
We didn't get that far. I'm sure she did, or you wouldn't have left her.
When is he coming home?
As soon as he can travel.
Don't be so sure.
For $11 billion, I might stick around for a while.
Chapter 36 The doctor found his patient snoring in the shade of the courtyard, still sitting up in bed, mouth open, gauze removed, head fallen to one side. His friend from the river was napping on the ground nearby. He studied the IV bag and stopped the flow. He touched Nate's forehead and felt no fever.
"Signor O'Reilly," he said loudly as he tapped the patient's shoulder.
Chevy jumped to his feet. The doctor did not speak English. He wanted Nate to return to his room, but when this was translated by Chevy, it was not well received. Nate pleaded with Chevy, and Chevy begged the doctor. Chevy had seen the other patients, the open sores, the seizures, and dying men just down the hall, and he promised the doctor he would sit right there in the shade with his friend until dark. The doctor relented. He really didn't care. Across the courtyard was a small, separate ward with thick black bars sunk in cement. Patients wandered out from time to time to gawk through the bars into the courtyard. They could not escape. A screamer appeared late in the morning and took offense at the presence of Nate and Chevy across the way. He had brown, spotted skin and red, patchy hair, and looked as crazy as he was. He clasped two bars, stuck his face between them, and began yelling. His voice was shrill and echoed around the courtyard and down the halls.
"What's he saying?" Nate asked.
The lunatic's yelling startled him and helped clear his head.
"I can't understand a word. He's insane. They have me in the same hospital with the crazy people?"
"Yes. Sorry, it's a small town."
The yelling intensified. A nurse from the safe side appeared and shouted for him to be quiet. He lashed back at her with language that made her run away. Then he refocused on Nate and Chevy. He squeezed the bars until his knuckles were white and began hopping as he screamed.
"Poor guy," Nate said.
The screaming turned to wailing, and after a few minutes of non-stop racket, a male nurse appeared behind the man and attempted to lead him away. He didn't want to go, and a short scuffle ensued. With witnesses, the nurse was firm but cautious. The man's hands, however, were glued around the bars and could not be removed. The wailing turned to shrieking as the nurse tugged from behind. Finally, the nurse gave up and disappeared. The screamer pulled down his pants and began peeing through the bars, laughing loudly as he aimed in the general direction of Nate and Chevy, who were out of range. While his hands were free, the nurse suddenly attacked from the rear, grabbing him in a full Nelson and dragging him away. Once he was out of sight, the yelling ceased immediately. When the daily drama was over and the courtyard was once again quiet, Nate said,
"Chevy, get me out of here."
"What do you mean?"
"Get me out of here. I feel fine. The fever is gone. My strength is returning. Let's go."
"We can't leave until the doctor releases you, and you have that," he added, pointing to the IV in Nate's left forearm.
"This is nothing," Nate said as he quickly slid the needle from his arm and yanked the IV free. "Find me some clothes, Chevy. I'm checking out."
"You don't know dengue. My father had it."
"It's over. I can feel it."
"No, it's not. The fever will return, and it will be worse, much worse."
"I don't believe that."
"Take me to a hotel, Chevy, please. I'll be fine there. I'll pay you to stay with me, and if the fever returns, you can feed me pills. Please, Chevy."
Chevy was standing at the foot of the bed. He glanced around as if someone might understand their English.
"I don't know," he said, wavering. It was not such a bad idea. "I'll pay you $200 to get me some clothes and take me to a hotel, and I'll pay you $50 a day to guard me until I'm okay."
"It's not about money, Nate. I'm your friend."
"And I'm your friend, Chevy. And friends help friends. I can't go back to that room. You saw those poor sick people in there. They're all rotting and dying and pissing all over themselves. It smells like human waste. The nurses don't care. The doctors don't check on you. The insane asylum is just over there. Please, Chevy, get me out of here. I'll pay you good money."
"Your money went down with the Santa Lola."
That stopped him cold. Nate had not even thought about the Santa Lola and his belongings, his clothes, money, passport, and briefcase with all the gadgets and papers Josh had sent. There had been few lucid moments since leaving Rachel, just a few clear intervals during which he had thought about living and dying, never about tangible things or assets.
"I can get plenty of money, Chevy. I'll wire it in from the States. Please help me."
Chevy knew that dengue was rarely fatal. Nate's bout with it appeared to be under control, though the fever would surely return. No one could blame him for wanting to escape the hospital.
"Okay," he said, glancing around again. No one was near them. "I'll return in a few minutes."
Nate closed his eyes and contemplated his lack of a passport. And he had no cash, not a dime, no clothes, no toothbrush, no sat phone, cell phone, no calling cards. And matters weren't much better at home. From the ruins of his personal bankruptcy, he could expect to keep his leased car, his clothing and modest furniture, and the money put away in his IRA. Nothing else. The lease on his small condo in Georgetown had been surrendered during rehab. There was no place to go when he returned. No family to speak of. His two older kids in college were distant and unconcerned. The two middle schoolers from the second marriage had been taken far away by their mother. He hadn't seen them in 6 months, and had scarcely thought about them at Christmas. On his 40th birthday, Nate had won a $10 million verdict against a doctor who failed to diagnose cancer. It was the largest verdict of his career, and when the appeals were finished 2 years later, the firm collected over $4 million in fees. Nate's bonus that year had been $1.5 million. He was a millionaire for a few months until he bought the new house. There were furs and diamonds, cars and trips, some shaky investments. Then he started seeing a college girl who loved cocaine, and the wall cracked. He crashed hard and spent 2 months locked away. His second wife left with the money, then came back briefly without it. He'd been a millionaire. And now he imagined how he looked from the roof of the courtyard, sick, alone, broke, under indictment, afraid of the return home, and terrified of the temptations there. His quest to find Rachel had kept him focused. There was excitement in the hunt. Now that it was over and he was flat on his back again, he thought of Sergio and rehab and addictions and all the trouble waiting for him. Darkness was looming again. He couldn't spend the rest of his life riding Shawanaz up and down the Paraguay with Chevy and Welly, far removed from booze and drugs and women, oblivious to his legal troubles. He had to go back. He had to face the music one more time. A piercing squawk jolted him from his daydreams. The red-headed screamer was back. Chevy rolled the bed under a veranda, then down a hallway headed toward the front of the hospital. He stopped by a janitor's closet and helped the patient out of bed. Nate was weak and shaky, but determined to escape. Inside the closet, he ripped off the gown and put on a pair of baggy soccer shorts, a red T-shirt, the obligatory rubber sandals, a denim cap, and a pair of plastic sunshades. Though he looked the part, he did not feel the least bit Brazilian. Chevy had spent little on his outfit. He was adjusting the cap when he fainted. Chevy heard him hit the door. He quickly opened it and found Nate slumped in a pile with buckets and mops rattling around.
He clutched him under the arms and dragged him back to the bed. He rolled him into it and covered him with the sheet. Nate opened his eyes and said, "What happened?"
"You fainted," came the reply.
The bed was moving. Chevy was behind him. They passed two nurses who didn't seem to notice them.
"This is a bad idea," Chevy said. "Just keep going."
They parked near the lobby. Nate crawled out of bed, felt faint again, and began walking. Chevy placed a heavy arm around his shoulder and steadied him by clutching his bicep.
"Take it easy," Chevy kept saying. "Nice and slow."
No stares from the admissions clerks nor the sick people trying to get in. No odd looks from the nurses and orderlies smoking on the front steps. The sun hit Nate hard, and he leaned on Chevy. They crossed the street to where Chevy's massive Ford was parked. They narrowly avoided death at the first intersection.
"Could you please drive slower?" Nate snapped.
He was sweating and his stomach was rolling.
"Sorry," Chevy said,
and the truck slowed considerably. With charm and the promise of future payment, Chevy cajoled a double room out of the young girl at the front desk of the Palace Hotel.
"My friend is sick," he whispered to her, nodding at Nate, who certainly appeared ill.
Chevy didn't want the pretty lady to get the wrong idea. They had no bags. In the room, Nate collapsed on the bed. The little escape had tired him immensely. Chevy found the rerun of a soccer game on TV, but after 5 minutes was bored. He left to continue his flirting. Nate tried twice to get an international operator. He had a vague recollection of hearing Josh's voice on the phone, and he suspected that a follow-up was needed. On the second attempt, he got an earful of Portuguese. When she tried English, he thought he caught the words calling card. He hung up and went to sleep. The doctor called Valdir. Valdir found Chevy's truck parked on the street outside the Palace Hotel, and he found Chevy in the pool, sipping a beer. Valdir squatted at the edge of the pool.
"Where is Mr. O'Reilly?" he asked.
His irritation was obvious.
"Upstairs in his room," Chevy answered, then took another sip. "Why is he here?"
"Because he wanted to leave the hospital. Do you blame him?" Valdir's only surgery had been in Campo Grande, 4 hours away. No one with money would ever voluntarily submit themselves to the hospital in Corumbá.
"How is he?"
"I think he's fine."
"Stay with him."
"I don't work for you anymore, Mr. Valdir."
"Yes, but there is the matter of the boat."
"I can't raise it. I didn't sink it. A storm did. What do you want me to do?"
"I want you to watch Mr. O'Reilly."
"He needs money. Can you wire it in for him?"
"I suppose."
"And he needs a passport. He lost everything."
"Just watch him. I'll take care of the details."
The fever returned quietly during the night, warming his face as he slept, taking its time as it built momentum for the havoc to come. Its calling card was a row of tiny pellets of sweat lined perfectly above the eyebrows, then sweat in the hair that rested on the pillow. It simmered while he slept, stewing, preparing to erupt. It sent tremors, little waves of chills through his body, but he was fatigued and there were the remnants of so many chemicals that he kept sleeping. It built pressure behind his eyes so that when he did open them he would want to scream. It drained the fluids from his mouth. Nate finally groaned. He felt the vicious pounding of a jackhammer between his temples. When he opened his eyes, death awaited him. He was in a pool of sweat, his face on fire, his knees and elbows bending in pain.
"Chevy," he whispered. "Chevy!"
Chevy hit the switch for the table lamp between them, and Nate groaned even louder.
"Turn that off," he said.
Chevy ran to the bathroom and found a less direct source of light. For the ordeal, he had purchased bottled water, ice, aspirin, over-the-counter pain medications, and a thermometer. He thought he was prepared. An hour passed, and Chevy counted every minute of it. The fever climbed to 102, The chills came in waves so violent that the small bed rattled and shook on the floor. When Nate wasn't shaking, Chevy stuffed pills in his mouth and poured down water. He soaked his face with wet towels. Nate suffered in silence, bravely gritting his teeth so that the pain was quiet. He was determined to suffer through the fevers in the relative luxury of the small hotel room. Every time he wanted to scream, he remembered the cracked plaster and smells of the hospital. At 4 a.m., the fever climbed to 103, and Nate began to drift away. His knees almost touched his chin. His arms were wrapped around his calves. He held himself tightly. Then a chill would hit and untangle him as his body shuddered. The last temperature reading was 105, and Chevy knew at some point his friend would go into shock. He finally panicked, not from the temperature, but from the sight of sweat dripping from the bed sheets onto the floor. His friend had suffered enough. There were better drugs at the hospital. He found a janitor asleep on the third floor, and together they dragged Nate to the elevator, through the empty lobby and to his truck. He called Valdir at 6 a.m., waking him. When Valdir finished cursing Chevy, he agreed to call the doctor. Chapter 37. The treatment was phoned in from the doctor's bed. Fill the IV bag with lots of goodies, poke the needle in his arm, try to find a better room. The rooms were full, so they simply left him in the hall of the men's ward, near a messy desk they called the nurse's station. At least they couldn't ignore him. Chevy was asked to leave. There was nothing he could do but wait. At one point in the morning, during a lull in other activities, an orderly appeared with a pair of scissors. He cut off the new gym shorts and the new red T-shirt and replaced them with another yellow gown. In the process, Nate lay naked on the bed for 5 full minutes in plain view of everyone passing by. No one noticed. Nate certainly didn't care. The sheets were changed because they were soaked. The rags that had been the shorts and shirt were thrown away, and once again Nate O'Reilly had no clothes. If he shook too much or moaned too loud, the nearest doctor or nurse or orderly would gently open the IV. And when he was snoring too loud, someone would close it a little. A cancer death created an opening. Nate was rolled into the nearest room, where he was parked between a worker who just lost a foot and a man dying from kidney failure. The doctor saw him twice during the day. The fever wavered between 102 and 104. Valdir stopped by late in the afternoon for a chat, but Nate was not awake. He reported the day's events to Mr. Stafford, who was not pleased.
"The doctor says this is normal," Valdir said, speaking into his cell phone in the hallway. "Mr. O'Reilly will be fine."
"Don't let him die, Valdir," Josh growled from America.
Money was being wired. They were working on the passport. Once again, the IV bag dripped itself empty, and no one noticed. Hours passed, and the drugs gradually wore off. It was pitch dark, the middle of the night, and there was no movement from the other three beds when Nate finally shook off the cobwebs of his coma and showed signs of life. He could barely see his roommates. The door was open, and there was a faint light down the hallway. No voices, no feet shuffling by. He touched his gown and realized he was again naked underneath. The gown was drenched from the sweat. He rubbed his swollen eyes and tried to straighten his cramped legs. His forehead was very hot. He was thirsty and could not remember his last meal. He tried not to move for fear of waking those around him. Surely a nurse would stop by soon. The sheets were wet, so when the chills began again, there was no way to get warm. He shook and vibrated, rubbing his arms and legs, his teeth clapping together. After the chills stopped, he tried to sleep and managed a few naps as the night wore on, but when it was darkest, the fever rose again. His temples pounded so hard that Nate began to cry. He wrapped the pillow around his head and squeezed as hard as he could. In the darkness of the room, a silhouette entered and moved from bed to bed, finally stopping beside Nate's. She watched him flounder and fight under the sheets, his low moans muffled by the pillow. She touched him gently on the arm. "Nate," she whispered. Under normal circumstances, he would have been startled, but hallucinating had become a common symptom. He lowered the pillow to his chest and tried to focus on the figure. "It's Rachel," she whispered. "Rachel?" he whispered, his breathing labored. He tried to sit up, then tried to open his eyes with his fingers. "Rachel?" "I'm here, Nate. God sent me to protect you." He reached for her face, and she took his hand. She kissed his palm. "You are not going to die, Nate," she said. "God has plans for you." He could say nothing. Slowly his eyes adjusted, and he could see her. "It's you," he said. Or was it another dream? He reclined again, resting his head on the pillow, relaxing as his muscles unclenched themselves and his joints became loose. He closed his eyes, but still held her hand. The pounding behind his eyes faded. The heat left his forehead and face. The fever had sapped his strength, and he drifted away again into a deep sleep induced not by chemicals, but by sheer exhaustion. He dreamed of angels, white-robed young maidens floating in the clouds above him, there to protect him, humming hymns he'd never heard, but that somehow seemed familiar. He left the hospital at noon the next day, armed with his doctor's orders and accompanied by Jevi and Valdir. There was no trace of fever, no rash, just a little soreness in the joints and muscles. He insisted on leaving, and the doctor readily concurred. The doctor was happy to be rid of him. The first stop was a restaurant where he consumed a large bowl of rice and a plate of boiled potatoes. He avoided the steaks and chops. Jevi did not. They were both still hungry from their adventure. Valdir sipped coffee, smoked his cigarettes, and watched them eat. No one had seen Rachel come and go at the hospital. Nate had whispered the secret to Jevi, who had inquired of the nurses and maids. After lunch, Jevi left them and began roaming downtown on foot, searching for her. He went to the river, where he talked to deckhands on the last cattle boat. She had not traveled with them. The fishermen hadn't seen her. No one seemed to know anything about the arrival of a white woman from the Pantanal. In Valdir's office, alone, Nate dialed the number of the Stafford law firm, a number he had trouble remembering. They pulled Josh out of a meeting. "Talk to me, Nate," he said. "How are you?" "The fever is gone," he said, rocking in Valdir's easy chair. "I feel fine. A little sore and tired, but I feel good."
"You sound great. I want you home."
"Give me a couple of days."
"I'm sending a jet down, Nate. It'll leave tonight."
"No, don't do that, Josh. That's not a good idea. I'll get there whenever I want."
"Okay. Tell me about the woman, Nate."
"We found her. She is the illegitimate daughter of Troy Phelan, and she has no interest in the money."
"So how did you talk her into taking it?"
"Josh, you don't talk this woman into anything. I tried, got nowhere, so I stopped."
"Come on, Nate. Nobody walks away from this kind of money. Surely you talk some sense into her."
"Not even close, Josh. She is the happiest person I've ever met, perfectly content to spend the rest of her life working among her people. It's where God wants her to be."
"She signed the papers, though."
"Nope." There was a long pause as Josh absorbed it.
"You must be kidding," he finally said, barely audible in Brazil.
"Nope. Sorry, boss. I tried my best to convince her to at least sign the papers, but she wouldn't budge. She'll never sign them."
"Did she read the will?"
Yes.
And you told her it was $11 billion?
Yep. She lives alone in a hut with a thatched roof, no plumbing, no electricity, simple food and clothes, no phones or faxes, and no concern about the things she's missing. She's in the Stone Age, Josh, right where she wants to be, and money would change that.
It's incomprehensible.
I thought so, too, and I was there.
Is she bright?
She's a doctor, Josh, an M.D., and she has a degree from a seminary. She speaks 5 languages.
A doctor?
Yeah, but we didn't talk about medical practice litigation.
You said she was lovely.
I did?
Yeah, on the phone 2 days ago. I think you were stoned.
I was, and she is.
So you liked her?
We became friends. It would serve no purpose to tell Josh that she was in Corumbá. Nate hoped to find her quickly and, while in civilization, try to discuss Troy's estate.
It was quite an adventure, Nate said, to say the least. I've lost sleep worrying about you.
Relax, I'm still in one piece.
I wired $5,000. Valdir has it.
Thanks, boss.
Call me tomorrow.
Valdir invited him to dinner, but he declined. He collected the money and left on foot, loose again on the streets of Corumbá. His first stop was a clothing store where he bought underwear, safari shorts, plain white T-shirts, and hiking boots. By the time he hauled his new wardrobe 4 blocks to the Palace Hotel, Nate was exhausted. He slept for 2 hours. Chevy found no trace of Rachel. He watched the crowds on the busy streets. He talked to the river people he knew so well and heard nothing about her arrival. He walked through the lobbies of the downtown hotels and flirted with the receptionists. No one had seen an American woman of 42 traveling alone. As the afternoon wore on, Chevy doubted his friend's story. Dengue makes you see things, makes you hear voices, makes you believe in ghosts, especially in the night. But he kept searching. Nate roamed, too, after his nap and another meal. He walked slowly, pacing himself, trying to keep in the shade and always with a bottle of water in hand. He rested on the bluff above the river, the majesty of the Pantanal spread before him for hundreds of miles. Fatigue hit him hard, and he limped back to the hotel for another rest. He slept again, and when he awoke, Chevy was tapping on the door. They had promised to meet for dinner at 7. It was after 8, and when Chevy entered the room, he immediately began looking for empty bottles. There were none. They ate roasted chicken at a sidewalk cafe. The night was alive with music and foot traffic. Couples with small children bought ice cream and drifted back home. Teenagers moved in packs with no apparent destination. The bars spilled outdoors to the edges of the streets. Young men and women moved from one bar to the next. The streets were warm and safe. No one seemed concerned about getting shot or mugged. At a nearby table, a man drank a cold Brahma beer from a brown bottle, and Nate watched every sip. After dessert, they said goodbye and promised to meet early for another day of searching. Chevy went one direction, Nate another. He was rested and tired of beds. 2 blocks away from the river, and the streets were quieter. The shops were closed, the homes were dark, traffic was lighter. Ahead, he saw the lights of a small chapel. "That," he said almost aloud, "is where she'll be." The front door was wide open, so from the sidewalk Nate could see rows of wooden pews, the empty pulpit, the mural of Christ on the cross, and the backs of a handful of worshippers leaning forward in prayer and meditation. The organ music was low and soft, and it pulled him in. He stopped in the door and counted 5 people scattered among the pews, no 2 sitting together, no one with even the slightest resemblance to Rachel. Under the mural, the organ bench was empty. The music came from a speaker. He could wait. He had the time. She might appear. He shuffled along the back row and sat alone. He studied the crucifixion, the nails through his hands, the sword in his side, the agony in his face. Did they really kill him in such a dreadful manner? Along the way, at some point in his miserable secular life, Nate had read or heard the basic stories of Christ. The virgin birth, thus Christmas, the walking on the water, maybe another miracle or two. Was he swallowed by the whale, or was that someone else? And then the betrayal by Judas, the trial before Pilate, the crucifixion, thus Easter, and finally, the ascension into heaven. Yes, Nate knew the basics. Perhaps his mother had told him. Neither of his wives had been churchgoers, though number two was Catholic and they did midnight mass at Christmas every other year. Three more stragglers came from the street. A young man with a guitar appeared from a side door and went to the pulpit. It was exactly 9:30. He strummed a few chords and began singing, his face glowing with words of faith and praise. A tiny little woman, one pew up, clapped her hands and sang along. Maybe the music would draw Rachel. She had to crave real worship in a church with wooden floors and stained glass, with fully clothed people reading Bibles in a modern language. Surely she visited the churches when she was in Corumbá. When the song was finished, the young man read some scripture and began teaching. His Portuguese was the slowest Nate had encountered so far in his little adventure. Nate was mesmerized by the soft, slurring sounds and the unhurried cadence. Though he understood not a word, he tried to repeat the sentences. Then his thoughts drifted. His body had purged the fevers and chemicals. He was well-fed, alert, rested. He was his old self again. And that suddenly depressed him. The present was back, hand in hand with the future. The burdens he'd left with Rachel had found him again, found him then and there, in the chapel. He needed her to sit with him, to hold his hand and help him pray. He hated his weaknesses. He named them, one by one, and was saddened by the list. The demons were waiting at home, the good friends and the bad friends, the haunts and habits, the pressures he couldn't stand anymore. Life could not be lived with the likes of Sergio at $1,000 a day, and life could not be lived free on the streets. The young man was praying, his eyes clenched tightly, his arms waving gently upward. Nate closed his eyes too, and called God's name. God was waiting. With both hands he clenched the back of the pew in front of him. He repeated the list, mumbling softly every weakness and flaw and affliction and evil that plagued him. He confessed them all. In one long, glorious acknowledgment of failure, he laid himself bare before God. He held nothing back. He unloaded enough burdens to crush any three men, and when he finally finished, Nate had tears in his eyes. "I'm sorry," he whispered to God. "Please help me." As quickly as the fever had left his body, he felt the baggage leave his soul. With one gentle brush of the hand, his slate had been wiped clean. He breathed a massive sigh of relief. But his pulse was racing. He heard the guitar again. He opened his eyes and wiped his cheeks. Instead of seeing the young man in the pulpit, Nate saw the face of Christ in agony and pain, dying on the cross, dying for him. A voice was calling Nate, a voice from within, a voice leading him down the aisle. But the invitation was confusing. He felt many conflicting emotions. His eyes were suddenly dry. "Why am I crying in a small hot chapel, listening to music I don't understand, in a town I'll never see again?" The questions poured forth, the answers elusive. It was one thing for God to forgive his astounding array of iniquities, and Nate certainly felt as though his burdens were lighter. but it was a far more difficult step to expect himself to become a follower. As he listened to the music, he became bewildered. God couldn't be calling him. He was Nate O'Reilly, boozer, addict, lover of women, absent father, miserable husband, greedy lawyer, swindler of tax money. The sad list went on and on. He was dizzy. The music stopped, and the young man prepared for another song. Nate hurriedly left the chapel. As he turned a corner, he glanced back, hoping to see Rachel, but also to make sure God hadn't sent someone to follow him. He needed someone to talk to. He knew she was in Korumba, and he vowed to find her. Chapter 38. The despachante is an integral part of Brazilian life. No business, bank, law firm, medical group, or person with money can operate without the services of a despachante. He is a facilitator extraordinaire. In a country where the bureaucracy is sprawling and antiquated, the despachante is the guy who knows the city clerks, the courthouse crowd, the bureaucrats, the customs agents. He knows the system and how to grease it. No official paper or document is obtained in Brazil without waiting in long lines, and the despachante is the guy who'll stand there for you. For a small fee, he'll wait 8 hours to renew your auto inspection, then affix it to your windshield while you're busy at the office. He'll do your voting, banking, packaging, mailing. The list has no end. No bureaucratic obstacle is too intimidating. Firms of despachantes display their names in windows just like lawyers and doctors. They're in the yellow pages. The job requires no formal training. All one needs is a quick tongue, patience, and a lot of brass. Valdir's despachante in Corumbá knew another one in Sao Paulo, a powerful one with high contacts, and for a fee of $2,000, a new passport would be delivered. Jevi spent the next few mornings at the river, helping a friend repair a shawana. He watched everything and heard the gossip, not a word about the woman. By noon on Friday, he was convinced she had not arrived in Corumbá, at least not in the past 2 years.